The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
9:21 now. We're in a flat. It's a segment of a room in 14 Henrietta Street here in Dublin City, and we're joined by some people around the table. It feels like a breakfast table with the beautiful window looking out onto this gorgeous street. We have Jane Lynch, who lived on the second floor here in the 60s and 70s. We have Linda Dowling, whose grandmother was the owner, essentially, or lived in this flat for so long, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I think what we really need to do is talk quickly to Gemma Sexton, who's the head of visitor experience here at 14 Henrietta Street, just to give us an idea for people living at home going, okay, he's kind of rabbiting on, I'm not quite sure what he's talking about, where is he, what's happening? So we need to go to 1720, isn't that right? Just to start us off on a whirlwind tour of how we got here.
We do, yes, exactly. Hi, Ryan.
Hiya.
We're on Henrietta Street, which during the 18th century was the most exclusive street in Dublin, and it was built by Luke Gardner. And the address that we're in now is it's a townhouse built at the same time period, number 14, and this is a house that was built for one family in the 18th century. For Lord Richard Molesworth was the first owner of this house.
So you've mentioned Gardner. Is that like Gardner Street?
Like Gardner Street.
As in the same person.
Same
he
man.
Designed a lot of Dublin, is that
he
right?
He did, yeah.
And then his pal was Molesworth, as in Molesworth Street.
Yes, exactly.
And he got Molesworth in to live in this house.
With how many people? He chose all his pals to live on the street.
So how many Molesworths lived here?
So Richard Molesworth moved in with his wife, Mary, and their seven children.
You paused at his wife. You said with his wife, Mary.
Did I pause?
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
His second wife.
That's what I was wondering. Don't forget. This is on you. Because where was the first wife?
The first wife we won't mention. He moved on to the second wife. Anyway.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Nothing changes, really. So on they go, and they moved in here. So there was how many altogether here?
So there was 9 of them, and then about 20 servants, something like that. So that's really important to contextualise this house, and why we're here, because this house was built for one family. And then over the 3 centuries since then, we're talking about it became a multi-occupancy house that housed up to 17 families at a time.
So after Molesworth, and they left, and who moved in after that?
Oh, so there was other lords and ladies kind of went through this house up until about 1800, and then you've got this shift on the street, which I know Tim might talk about, where you've got the professional class moving onto the street,
and
you've
kings in.
And then we also had the encumbered estates here in the mid 19th century. We had the Dublin militia moved in, and then it wasn't until the 1870s that this house was bought by Thomas Vance, and he, as the landlord, made the decision to carve up the house into 17 one-room tenement flats.
So we've gone from a family of 6 to a house full of maybe 100 people.
Yes, according to the 1911 census, there was over 100 people living in this house at one time.
We need to get an idea of the conditions. So a typical room would have been divided, but not divided from ceiling to floor. This was something that intrigued me when I came to visit you a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
That I didn't really... Could you explain that to us, why there's the partitions?
Because the room that we're in now is divided up into 3 smaller rooms, and the partitions only go halfway up the ceiling. Very high ceilings.
Yes.
They've still got those Georgian ceilings. So privacy wouldn't be something that would be a bit of a luxury in these rooms. You could be whispering about somebody in the next room, and they'd hear everything you were saying.
Yeah, that's a very polite example to give of things you might do in private. But nevertheless, that's the nature of the thing. And I think you were saying that if there was if they had gone ceiling to floor with partitions, the darkness would have killed everything.
Exactly. So you needed the partitions to only go so high so that the light and air, of course, could move around the space.
One of the first things you see when you walk in here, Gemma, and everyone listening has the opportunity to come and visit the museum at some point, and I think it'd be great schools visible, we'll get to that in a minute, is the blue paint peeling off the wall and retaining that, but also maybe explain to me a bit about what Reckitt's blue, is that what it was called?
Yeah, well, I have to say, like, Dublin City Council did a wonderful thing in, saving and preserving and stabilising this building, and then having the vision to turn it into this museum. And what they've tried to do is the whole, I suppose, conservation ethos was to do as little as possible, but as much as was needed. And what that means is that you're seeing our main, I suppose, artifact of the museum is the fabric of the building yes. itself. So you can still see the layers of paint from throughout the ages, and specifically the tenement times, where you're seeing the red rattle and the Reckitt's blue. Those kind of, anyone who's lived in a tenement kind of recognise those iconic colours. Yeah. And some people talk about the smell, that they remember the smell of those colours because they contained a distemper in them that was, you had an antiseptic quality that was said to stave off disease. And of course, you know, when you've got so many people living in close quarters in a house like this,
yes.
If one person gets sick, then it becomes a real risk for everybody else.
Well, where do they keep the hand sanitizer? I mean, I say that by way of
important.
How far we've moved.
Yeah,
we've
because
come.
There was only one water source in a house
which
like
was
this.
Where?
That was in the basement.
But there's how many floors?
Oh, yeah, there's 5 floors.
Oh,
so, and it's amazing. And we, you know, from speaking to other people in other tenements, the water source would have been out the backyard, you know.
So this was a luxury situation,
yes,
in some
it
way.
Was.
You talked about luxury. If there was a front door on the tenement building, is that right? That indicated
yeah.
a sort of elevation?
Yes, I suppose. And that what's quite interesting is that the front door was always open in these houses, and the back door as well. So you had a lot of people moving in and out of these houses day to day.
Linda Dowling, will you please tell me about your grandmother, Elizabeth Dowling, whose ghost haunts us today for all the right reasons, because we're in her place. So talk to me about her.
Yes.
What do we know about her, your
yeah,
grandmother?
She lived here then until the mid-1970s, and she lived here then. She had 3 children, my father Joseph and Peter and Lily, and her Elizabeth as well. And so they were here from the mid-1930s. And this is basically where they grew up, you know.
And did you know much about where she lived when you were young?
Yeah, well, until, like, I lived in London as a kid, and we used to come back every summer on holidays and we'd visit her here.
Oh, you came here?
Yeah, to
okay.
the house. Yeah, so I'd have been sitting here 40-odd years ago on her couch, you know, for summer to visit her, you know.
And do you remember when she moved out of here?
Yeah, she moved in the mid-70s, and she moved down to Dominic Street, and she probably, I think, was one of the last residents of the house, you know.
Yes.
I think they talked her out of it because it was kind of, there weren't many people in the house, and it was kind of a dangerous place for really for her to be living on her own, you
yeah.
know. But she kicked up a stink. She didn't really want to move at all, you
and
know.
Your home's your home, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, so I do remember, they've done a fabulous job.
So how did you come to be aware that the museum was kicking into life, and that your yeah. grandmother's flat was going to be such an integral part of the living history?
It was gas, actually, because it's just on Facebook. I saw an Architecture Ireland post, and Dublin City Council had put up the partitions in the room, and
in this room
of this room, you know, of the ground floor room, and I recognised it, and I commented on it that you've got the partitions are wrong. That was my grandmother's flat.
Great, good on you.
And then Charles Duggan, who's the main historian for the project from Dublin City Council, he was on to me practically the next day, you know, saying, God, it was great to hear from you. Would you like to be involved, you know?
Great.
So, yeah, it was great.
And you got involved. So could you, because the people listening at home, they're trying to get a feel for what class of room we're in. Can you describe what yeah. they've got right here in terms of, what are we looking
yeah.
at? The different things that really are resonant for you
for
and
me,
your granny
yeah.
and the
house. Light was one of the things as well, because, you know, they wouldn't, this is lit up when you walk in, but that single light, the partitions would cause shadows around the place. I kind of have dark memories, particularly of the kitchen area, do you know? But you walked in, they got the kitchen completely right, you know, and all the product placement stuff, people, I know, sort of resonates with people. But when you walked into the room, I remember walking in the first time, like the wallpaper, my grandmother would have wallpapered here, but apparently yeah. they reconstructed that, and the lino from segments they found on the floor.
Brilliant.
The piano, Lily played a piano when she was a kid, so you know, they went to great lengths to get a baby piano in. The cabinet came, we found that down, it was my grandmother's, and we found that down in Clonakilty.
Did you?
And my Auntie Rose had that all along. The doll, the baby doll in it, that scares most kids to death.
It's actually like so many Victorian and beyond yeah. Dolls, they're terrifying and
yeah.
most likely do come alive and do desperate things after midnight, but that's
yeah.
part of the furniture
yeah.
in many ways.
Yeah.
What else are
yeah.
we looking at? The radio?
The whole mantle and the fireplace is very accurate, I believe. I don't really remember that. I do remember the open fireplace, but others would say like it was pretty accurate, you know, and cousins
yeah.
that have been in and that.
Sewing machine inside.
Yeah, sewing machine. Lily was a seamstress for a couple of years. She worked in a sewing factory, and they duplicated that. The only thing that's probably different a little bit is this partition was further up here.
Yeah.
My grandmother had had this giant, I remember as a kid, you know, it being a big bed and white candlewick, and no one went into her bedroom.
Of course. But was it strange for you to come through the door?
Oh, it was very emotional. The Hentown play was the first time I was back in. And New Productions had this thing about, you know, Dublin in the, I think maybe 1950s plus.
Sure.
And I remember walking in and the actors were jumping around the room, and I felt terribly emotional. It was like, you know, seeing my dad and his brother popping around the place, getting ready for a night out.
Yeah, can I imagine. Yeah. And the piano had, there were residents in the piano, is
there
that right? Uninvited.
Piano,
who was living there?
Yeah, Lily always told myself and my daughters the story of she'd start to play the piano and the mice would run out and my dad would be ready with a hammer.
That must be the most beautiful and messy evening's entertainment. You can imagine. It's kind of like Bagpuss with a massacre. Amazing. Jane Lynch is here, and Jane, you're nice to see you. Tell us about where you lived for how long, what era?
I lived up on the second floor from 1961 to 1972 with my mum Jane Lynch, dad Billy Lynch, deceased, and my brother and three sisters. So we were considered a small family.
Yes, you would have been. How many rooms, if you know, were you in a room that was divided?
A room not unlike this that was partitioned off, where you would have had the scullery area, the living room area, and the bedroom area. And my mum and dad's bed would have been in the living room area, where you had your table for your food. And
where did you all sleep, all the youngsters?
We slept behind the partition.
Right. How do you remember it? Do you kind of have this kind of strange nostalgia, or do you think, God, it was desperate? Like, how do you feel?
No, I actually have strange nostalgia.
Do you?
Genuinely. My mother's priority would have been heat, so we would have had the fire lit.
Yeah.
We would have had, I recognise the old army coats and the turf bags at the end of the bed, you know, for the heat.
Yeah.
But the main memory, because today has moved on so much, is the bath. The steel bath on a Saturday night in front of the fireplace, where a man would have to go down to the basement with pots and pans and buckets and boil the water, fill the bath. And if I got in tonight, my brother got in next, my sister.
How did you?
All in the same water.
But hang on, Jane. How did you decide who got first go of that?
I was the eldest, so that was a no-go. And then the next week, my brother, and then the next week, my second sister, all the way down.
So the last one in was really stewing in filth.
Yeah, and cold water.
Cold water. Now, one of the things I recall from coming here before was Linda's, in the kitchen area, was the Sunlight soap.
Yes.
And I took a smell off it, and it's very distinctive. And the guys were telling me that anyone who comes in goes, that's the smell. Could you tell me about Sunlight soap?
And red carbolic soap.
Tell me about it.
The women would be down, they would wash their clothes.
Yep.
And the mangle, or they'd be washing the floor with the Sunlight soap.
Yes.
But it could be on your stockings, it could be on your hair, but it was just like a clean, really, really distinctive smell.
Kind of, not to be too glib, but it's kind of ecologically sound. You know, everything was used, everything was reused. It was kind of ahead of its time, but probably not for reasons that they necessarily wanted. But when you look back at it now, things like water, toilet, all this sort of thing, does it feel like the dark ages now?
Oh, genuinely now. Oh, definitely, yeah.
And how was the toilet situation for you?
Not to be rude, another steel bucket under a curtain in the scullery that was brought downstairs and emptied next morning.
You slopped out, essentially.
That's it.
And whose job was it, Jane, to slop out?
Oh, my dad's, of course.
He was always tapped on the shoulder for that.
He was the leader of that one.
Was there?
And Jade's fluid would be the very common smell because of that.
Because of that. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And was there a sense of, for example, community?
Did people? Oh, very much so.
When did people most come together?
For anything. I mean, there was the Rockman Football Club. They would have organise the groups for the children. There would be games out in the street. The temple was the King's Inn, which is the temple.
Yeah.
That was our playground. We played on the swings. We played the rounders. We played the piggy beds. The adults would be sitting on the steps. It was just a community. If you were in some flat and they were having their tea or their dinner, you got part of it. They had nothing, but they always shared.
It's funny, isn't it? Because if you had the King's Inn's heads up there, the students and lecturers and so on, and you were here in a tenement, I mean, if ever a tale of two cities...
Coming together.
Right, because they'd be walking past you. And were they nice people, did you think, or were they very much over there?
never really thought of it.
I mean, never stopped and said hello or...
Well, they might have nodded or you might, you know, if you recognise somebody, you might, but never actually as a kid saw the distinction or felt the distinction.
You just got on with your life.
Just got on with your life. Yeah.
So you've got fond memories then here,
oh,
really.
Oh, genuinely.
Despite all of the baths and the toilets and all that. But it was what it was. When did you leave?
1972.
And were you sorry to go or...
Oh, yes.
Were you?
But we were lucky because we moved to Constitution Hill, so we're still up and down the street.
So you're really, the street's in your bones, isn't it?
Yeah,
I can sense that talking to you. Tim Murta, thank you, by the way, Jane.
Thank you.
Tim Murta is a historian, also visiting researcher here at Henrietta Street. Thanks for coming to see us today, Tim. I suppose what's so interesting about this building is, you know that expression, if the walls could speak, they would tell so many stories. But the three big moments that live in the shadow of this house, the Act of Union, 1801. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, the Act of Union, obviously, hugely important moment in Irish history, but particularly in Dublin's history. And the great thing about Henrietta Street is that, in many ways, Henrietta Street sort of is a sort of microcosm for all the big stories that happen in Dublin.
Sure.
Sort of, the Act of Union is no different. The Union, obviously, results in the sort of abolishment of the Irish Parliament. And what that does is it means that the elites who had been coming to Dublin in the 18th century, and of course, who needed accommodation to attend the Irish Parliament, are now going to London to spend their disposable income, which means that you have several big knock-on effects. Places like Henrietta Street no longer have the parliamentary elite looking for accommodation here. You also have a knock-on effect for the working class because Dublin's economy begins to struggle going into the 19th century. You no longer have these luxury good trades, which had been sort of pitching their wares to, again, this parliamentary elite. So you have industrial decline, and you also have sort of an exodus of the sort of high spenders. So that has a really interesting effect. Now, it is gradual. Henrietta Street doesn't go from being sort of elite townhouse to a slum overnight. There's intermediary stages.
Yes.
And several of that is basically the professionalisation of Dublin.
The famine 1845 was relevant to here because you had what's called the Encumbered Estates Court.
Yeah, the Encumbered
Estates... Mouthful, but...
Yeah. The Encumbered Estates Court has sort of been compared to a sort of Victorian version of NAMA. It's essentially all these landlords who go bust during the famine for multiple reasons, some of which is their own bad spending, some of it is sort of bad estate management, some of it's the famine itself. So all these estates are essentially heavily in debt, and there's issues about actually selling them on. It's confusing who actually controls the title deed.
Yeah.
So the government steps in, the state takes control of these, and then it sells them on to clear the sort of land market. And it was number 14 that was actually chosen as the offices of this estate court. All four floors were used by the various offices. There was actually a coach house at the back of the property, which was turned into sort of the courtroom and also auction room. There's accounts in the 1850s of sort of these sort of, you know, whirlwind buying auctions for, you know, these huge estates down the country, and they're all happening here.
God.
You also have accounts of sort of very angry landlords who are discovering that they're so heavily in debt, they're losing their estate, and they're coming up here to sort of give out to the commissioners.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, if the house could talk, there's a movie in it, no question about it. Thanks very much indeed for that, Tim. We've got to take a quick break. Before we do that, I'll tell you that coming up, we have retired Judge Gillian Hussey. And Gillian is somebody I've had the pleasure to meet in her capacity as representative of Tig Lynn. And we've kind of soldiered together a couple of afternoons up there having the odd burger and a chat. She's very kindly, as we're in the shadows of the legal hub of the nation, agreed to come in and see us today. And we will bring her in to join us at this table at Henrietta Street after this break. Oakley Wall Garden. Tintern Abbey, says Celine, is an amazing place. Everyone should visit. You'll love it. A really special Country Pub of the Year winner. I'm there already. Vine Cottage sits on the edge of it and in the old village of Salt Mills, and it's beautiful. And I'm from Kildare. Thank you for that. Elsewhere, Brian Cleary and Bray did some of the reupholstery work in 14 Henrietta Street, listing in this morning. I visited with my family, who are 12, 14 and 16 during the summer. Great to visit. Very informative. Very educational. Fiona says, we live in Dublin 16. My daughter just started secondary school across the road in the Mount Carmel Girls Secondary, King's Inn Street. And I park on Henrietta Street every morning, watch across the road. She's so happy. The school is the best kept secret. And I'm also invigorated getting out of suburbia every day and experiencing such an interesting part of the city, watching the world go by on such an historic street. And another says, great to hear you coming from the 14 Henrietta Street. Might you consider a visit to Richmond Barracks Museum? The answer to that is yes, but let's get this show done and then we'll plan the next one afterwards. But thank you for that. But let's do a quick message from Teresa.
Theresa Neville's in London this morning and listening to the programme. What a coincidence that you're there. I, with my father and daughter, made a visit to the museum last Friday. We only live in Phibsborough up the road, and it was a wonderful experience capturing the history of the house through the passionate guide and the films. You get a picture of what it was like to live there. I'd highly recommend a visit, and well done for promoting this wonderful Dublin experience. That's for sure. Peter Brannigan, nice to see you again.
And you too, right?
You know, I just want to get a handle. I'm trying to get my head around, you know, people, it's a wonderful Dublin in the rare old times and all that. You know, you were born in the basement and you lived here, and I'm just wondering about the rose tint and the glasses and how fair that is to the residents of here. Or is it because it's all they knew, therefore there's no problem?
It's all they knew, Ryan. And you were down in the basement yourself.
I was,
and you've
yeah.
seen the conditions there. But as children, you don't, they don't bother you at all.
Yeah,
you know,
you get on with it.
You just go on with it.
Yeah,
you know, and as you say, you had Linda here talking to you, and I was a great friend of her dad's, Joe. We were friends.
Yeah,
and another friend of ours, Joe Fitzgerald, his sister was only in there 2 weeks ago, and he passed away as well.
Oh, okay.
So that was very sad.
Okay.
So that was Joe, and myself.
So that's the sort of the history is yeah. drifting, but then yeah. but it comes to life again then when you have a house like this, yeah. a museum like this. Yeah. So you were born in 1939, July 1939.
Yes, yeah.
And I don't know if it's a silly question, but why were you born in the basement?
My mother left it too late.
I'd be grand. I'm not grand. We're up. What happened? I mean, obviously, you're not going to remember all the detail, but what were you told subsequent? About?
Well, it's told I was born down there, and as you know, I visited the basement. I was pretty lucky to be born in the summertime rather than the wintertime.
Weren't you, though?
Absolutely.
Could have been a very different story.
It could have been, very easily.
Donal Fallon is a historian, broadcaster, friend of the programme. It's good to see you again, Donal. Thanks
good
for coming
again.
In today. You bring people on the tours of the museum. I'm always fascinated to get children interested and keen to go. What do they want to know?
Well, my primary function here has actually been collecting memories of people who lived in this house, and also the story of what came after Henrietta Street. You know, the great movement of people from the inner city into the suburbs. And that famous Brendan Behan quip that there was no such thing as suburbia, only Siberia. That feeling. And yeah. in Peter's case, the family moved to Donnycarney. And I remember when I interviewed you, Peter, you talked about the handcarts, the endless stream of them making their way from Henrietta Street to there. So yeah. my job here primarily is to interview people that have memories of this street and tenement Dublin more broadly.
And what are the most common memories
yeah,
that
I mean,
people have?
Reoccurring themes would yes. be labour. Or the absence of labour. I mean, the lack of work in Dublin throughout the 20th century. But also the great sense of alienation that was often there when you move out. I mean, you look at these beautiful houses in Kimmage and Crumlin and Cabra and the like, and for many people it was a great new start. But they also felt that they lost something. And while these streets are maybe synonymous in some people's mind with poverty, what I find in the interviews is that there was a real tremendous sense of community here. And the fact that the door was never open. You may have lived in a room in this house, but the entire building felt like home and the entire street felt like home.
It's funny, isn't it? And because we have all the mod cons, and it's quite hard to, as I say, to kind of fathom the contentment with which one might live in such conditions. Leo, tell us about your connection with Henrietta Street.
Well,
the
only connection I have is I'm an interloper because I was born in Wood Quay. But our house wasn't as fancy as this. We didn't have all these cornices. The ceilings weren't as high. I was born on the top of it, and we had what we had, a very good room on the first floor.
Yes.
And that was only used for visits and priests and holy days and things like that. But, I mean, there was 20 of us in the house with a toilet in the back, two toilets in the back and the tap, and then with a Belfast sink on the very top. And again, like everybody else said, we were born at home because that was the done thing, like, you know. It wasn't that my mother left it later or anything, like, you know.
Yes.
But the community was the important thing. You keep talking about, like, what did we miss? Well, if you never had it, you never missed it.
That's it.
Well, what we had was shared. Like, there was two old ladies below us, and I ended up collecting the turf for them, you know. And then when we were sick, they looked after us. My mother got their messages. Now, I always think of it, Henneman's house, as a vertical village. You have
That's
people
nice
above you
puddings.
And below
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
But it was still that community. There was a lady on the road who had, I think, probably from arthritis, had her hands very disfigured. But she laid out the dead, and she was there at the births.
It's amazing.
So it's a lovely idea.
Sinead, Give us a few bars of that before we go. Can you? If you come in a bit, Leo, so that Sinead can move her arms. God help us. Yeah, this will play us out. Dublin in the Rare Old Times from the Tenement Museum. Lads, thanks all so much for coming in. Peter, Leo, Donal, thanks a million for coming in to see us today. Thanks to all the staff here at 14 Henrietta Street. You've been brilliant. What a museum. Go online to find the details. Thanks to all our friends for showing up today, to Tom Norton, Mick McLaughlin and the team here, and everyone at Dublin City Council for pulling this together. It's a beautiful job. We're going to leave it there for now. Stay tuned for Sean O'Rourke. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.